From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It has been a long, hard stretch for Europe. First, the financial crisis pitted nation against nation. Then came the rise of right-wing politics. But it was the refugees fleeing wars and poverty that brought all of the EU's challenges and tensions to the surface. Don't sit back and watch, America, says my guest today. Europe needs us, and we need Europe. This hour on Point, Europe's crisis, America's challenge. You can join us on air or online. Do you see a Europe in deep trouble? What does it mean for the U.S. if the European Union splits apart, cracks under the weight of these refugees? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Budapest is John Shattuck, former Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, former ambassador to the Czech Republic. He is currently president of the Central European University in Budapest. His recent opinion piece in the Boston Globe is called "The U.S. Needs to Help the EU and the Refugee Crisis," and you can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. John Shattuck, so nice to have you with us. Thanks.
Very glad to be with you. Thank you, Jane.
So President Obama recently returned from Europe. Of course, Europe deeply divided over the issue of refugees. You've been living in Europe these past 7 years. What do you see happening across the continent right now with regard to this refugee crisis?
Well, there's a great deal of division in Europe, as I think everybody's been reading. European countries are going in many different directions, and the possibility that the EU could, in fact, fall apart over the refugee crisis is very real. There's a rise of nationalism and xenophobia. There's obviously a fear of terrorism, which is understandable as a result of the two recent attacks in Europe. But there's overwhelming pressure on Europe to accept refugees who are desperate and fleeing from conflict zones where they're piled up in the frontline states of Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. There are only now a million refugees, approximately, who've made it to Europe. But then there are over 11 million Syrian refugees or Syrians who have been displaced by the conflict, and approximately 4 million refugees who are living now in camps in the area that is Jordan and Turkey and Lebanon. And Europe has been, some European countries have been very welcoming. The Germans have been remarkably welcoming. I was in the refugee camps in Greece last week, and I would say the Greeks, who have a long history themselves of being refugees, are being quite welcoming. On the other hand, there are countries in Central Europe, among them Hungary and Poland and Slovakia, that are now playing essentially the nationalist and xenophobic arguments out to their public, saying we refugees are dangerous and we should keep them out. There's even some racist remarks that are being made related to the fact that they're all coming from the Middle East and they're Muslims. And then, of course, you have the pressures on the European Union coming from Britain, which is getting ready to vote whether or not it's going to exit the EU. That's not so much about the refugee crisis. It's more a general indication of the pressures on Europe. So Europe is really right now in a lot of difficulty in terms of the European Union and its survival.
Hmm. And so many issues, as you say, are converging here. Let me play a bit from President Obama's speech last Monday, where he urged Europeans to, quote, resist tribalism. Here he is in Hanover, Germany, speaking to the people of Europe about not turning their backs on refugees.
And I know it may seem easy for me to say all this living on the other side of the ocean. And I know that some will call it blind hope when I say that I am confident that the forces that bind Europe together are ultimately much stronger than those trying to pull you apart. But hope is not blind when it is rooted in the memory of all that you've already overcome. Your parents, your grandparents.
So be guided by the forces pulling you together that are stronger than the ones pulling you apart. You write, John Shattuck, that Obama's vision is, quote, oddly out of sync with the reality that the European Union is at risk of breaking apart. Is that what you see? Is that what you see in the future, Europe spinning out of control?
No, I think this can be prevented. But what I say in my piece, and certainly what I strongly believe, is that it's time for the United States to start playing a much more active role on the refugee crisis. At the moment, we've really been a bystander. We're only taking in approximately 10,000 Syrian refugees, and many of those haven't even been resettled in the U.S. yet. But 10,000 is a minuscule number compared with the over 500,000 who are now being resettled in Germany. We also are contributing, and rightly so, to the UN refugee agencies that are helping, but only about one quarter the amount that all European countries themselves are contributing. So Europe is on the front lines here, and my point is that the United States has major security and economic interests in the survival of Europe and the survival of the European Union. Sure, there is a major humanitarian crisis, but to put it even more broadly, there's a security crisis. If Europe falls apart, the European Union, the dangers of more conflict emerging on the European continent are very real. I was involved in the war in Bosnia and ending the war in Bosnia, working with Richard Holbrooke when I was in the government, so I know exactly what that's like. Mm-hmm. Pressures coming from the east in Moscow and what we see with Putin. So, you know, this is a very real challenging time. On the economic side, few people realize that the European Union is by far and away the largest trading partner in the world of the United States, far larger than China, for example, which many people think is our major trading partner. So we have an economic stake in this as well. And so my point is simply that it's time for the U.S. to step up, to resettle more refugees, and to provide more assistance to the refugee resettlement agencies that are doing all this frontline work.
Let me ask you more about that, but let's hear first from Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan, who in November called for a pause in the U.S. refugee program.
It's important that we have a refugee system in place. We respect that. But we think it's simply prudent that for this particular program, in this particular situation, that we be better guarded against any possible infiltration of ISIS coming through this program.
And here's Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California pushing back on those in Congress calling for that pause of the refugee settlement program. She spoke with NPR's Elsa Chang.
This rush to judgment that you're going to leave refugees out there in the winter with small children freezing in Europe is certainly not the American way.
You talk about the economic implications here, John Shattuck. Explain to us exactly why the security of the United States and its international standing is quite reliant on a stable and cohesive Europe.
Well, our biggest alliance in the world and our most important one is NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which, of course, was created to prevent another world war of the kind that we saw. And so NATO and the European Union are integrally bound together, and our security depends on the future not only of NATO but also of the EU in terms of keeping that security structure. But let me speak very specifically to the points that were made by Mr. Ryan. The U.S. now has the most vigorous vetting system of any country in the world for refugees who are resettled. And so, you know, all the various security agencies are deeply involved, the National Counterterrorism Center, the Department of Defense, and certainly the CIA. And so we have a very extensive way of reviewing the security of the situation involving refugees who are admitted. And I just want to point out that there are 20 former secretaries of state, national security advisors, CIA directors, and military leaders of both parties in the United States who have strongly endorsed an increased number of refugees coming in, particularly through as a result with this security system that I've described. Mm-hmm. And these include not only people you'd expect to be on that list who are former directors, people that I work closely with, like Madeleine Albright, for example. But they include Henry Kissinger, Brent Scowcroft, of course, who is the National Security Advisor for the first President Bush, Michael Chertoff, who worked in the George W. Bush administration, George Shultz, who is the Secretary of State for first President Bush, Michael Hayden, the former director of the CIA. These are serious people, and they say the security of the United States is at stake here if we continue to shut our doors to refugees from the Middle East, because the word is going to go out that the United States is biased, and which, of course, it's not, against Muslim refugees coming from the Middle East under circumstances which, in a way, have resulted from some earlier activities of the United States.
But you know what the charged political environment is right now in this country, John. I mean, the talk of immigration, the proposed wall on the Mexican border, many Americans strongly agree with these positions. What do you say to them? What do you say to Americans who suggest that the refugee crisis is really, at its core, a European problem?
Well, I think that what you say is to talk the facts, which is what I'm doing here. I mean, this is not so much an issue of ideology or an issue in any way of specifically, I mean, there's a major humanitarian side of it, but there's both a security and an economic side of it. And the United States' economic and physical security is bound up with that of Europe. And if the signal goes out that the U.S. is really shutting its doors to refugees from the Middle East, that's a very negative signal. That kind of signal can well result in the recruitment of more terrorists, which is obviously very much against the U.S. interests.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the continent of Europe, the European Union, facing its greatest challenges since World War II, and why that matters to Americans and what we should do about it. You can join the conversation. Is John Shattuck right that the U.S. needs to intervene? Or do you think it's Europe's problem? Last Monday, in a speech in Hanover, Germany, President Obama said that now is a defining moment for Europe. He warned Europeans that if they give in to doubt and question the progress that has been made since World War II, they cannot expect that progress to continue.
Instead, we will be empowering those who argue that democracy can't work, that intolerance and tribalism and organizing ourselves along ethnic lines and authoritarianism and restrictions on the press, that those are the things that the challenges of today demand.
My guest this hour, John Shattuck, former Assistant Secretary of State and now President of the Central European University in Budapest. His recent opinion piece in the Boston Globe is called The U.S. Needs to Help the EU End the Refugee Crisis. Let me bring in now Amber Corbett. She joins me from Norwich, England. When she saw the waves of refugees landing on Europe's shores, she decided she had to do her part and went to Calais, France. Amber, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
So,
nice to join you.
Well, it's great to have you. You raised money, took supplies into a refugee camp in Calais. Tell us about that camp. You call it the jungle. Why?
Yeah, the camp has been nicknamed the jungle. And I guess this is because of the harsh climate that's found there, the kind of chaotic environment that it presents. And I guess that's where the name has come from. But actually, I think upon arrival there, it's a lot less chaotic than you might imagine.
Here's some sound of police and workmen working in the migrant camp in Calais. It was demolished, and I want you to tell me why, Amber, after we hear this. Amber, so tell us, the destruction of this camp happened how long after it had been opened?
Just a mere couple of months. I know the camp itself has been established there for almost 20 years now, but only very recently in the current refugee crisis has it reached the scale that it was at the point of its demolition.
So tell us what the camp, what it was like there for refugees when it was operational.
Really, it's so hard to describe. It was such an incredible place to behold. The levels of organization that had been set up by volunteers and refugees alike was truly impressive. I would say that the functionality within it was incredible. The systems that had been put in place for providing shelter and supplies for refugees was great. Most of the volunteers I met there were actually from the UK, mm-hmm. But I've been told there are volunteers coming from around the world to help in both the warehouse and within the camp.
Their school there for mothers and children. I mean, it was, yeah.
So the team that I went with, there was a team of 12 individuals, and we actually set up a dome that served its purpose as a school and a center for women and children for the time it was standing before it was demolished. And really, the whole camp was a community. I mean, there was some division of different cultures and languages and areas within the camp, but at the heart of it, there was this feeling of hope. There were schools and bars and cafes, restaurants, shops. I mean, people had really set up this micro city really from nothing, from scratch. And it was kind of incredible to behold for that reason.
And so amidst this feeling of hope in this little micro city, why was it destroyed?
That's a question I'm still asking myself. I mean, as John mentioned earlier, there's this huge division in Europe about the refugee crisis and what should be done. There is this underlying fear of terror, and people have misconceptions about the numbers of refugees and whose responsibility it is to house them and who is to blame. And whilst we're all arguing over who should take responsibility for these people, decisions are being made by our government to the detriment of the refugees.
And do you understand the fear among Europeans about these camps?
I don't feel the fear myself. I feel that the fear can only come from what people see in the mainstream media. I mean, you just have to look at one of our main tabloid newspapers to see the kind of fear-mongering I'm talking about. You know, the build-up of Islamophobia in the UK, tabloid newspapers presenting views of Muslims as terrorists and there's no separation between the two. So there's this automatic association of Islam and ISIS. And I can say from going to the camp myself, these people aren't ISIS. You know, these are vulnerable human beings. These are families. These are skilled workers. These people are not ISIS. But I can see that people build this fear up from what they read in the media and also just a lack of understanding. You know, it's not something that everybody, you know, not everybody's been to the camp or seen the situation from themselves. So all they can base it on is what they see on the television and what they read in the news, which can be pretty terrifying.
Right. And so do you see this issue, these refugees in these camps at the very heart of a disintegrating EU, of a Europe that might soon be very fragmented because of this?
Absolutely. And I really hope that most people are going to vote to remain in the EU because, above all, this is a humanitarian issue. And really what should be happening is we should be unifying as the EU to resolve this situation.
Amber Corbett has been working with refugees in the so-called jungle refugee camp in Calais, France. She joined me today from Norwich, England. Amber, thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you. John Shattuck, jump back in here. What do you hear in Amber Corbett's story?
Well, I think she's been on the ground and seen exactly how much myth there is about some of these matters involving security and fears of terrorism. But on the other hand, there is, of course, an understandable fear, given the two huge attacks that took place in Paris and then in Brussels. But my own experience, I've just come back from the refugee camps in Greece. I was there last week, and I found quite a welcoming attitude on the part of many Greeks who are recognizing now that the refugees who had been passing through their country heading north previously are now at least about 57,000 of them trapped in Greece, and that's where they're going to be. So the Greeks are not overly concerned about the security matters. And what you see is overwhelmingly women, children, some men. There are certainly the Syrian refugees also include some men, quite well educated. I saw many people who have been displaced from their university careers, who are students in Syria and or even faculty members and are now, you know, living in these refugee camps. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the circumstances, I think, are quite different on the ground from those that are depicted, as she said, in the mainstream. I wouldn't call it mainstream. I'd call it some of the hysterical media depictions with mm-hmm. respect to security problems.
We've got – let me jump in here, John, because – we have strong feelings on both sides from our listeners. Let me read a couple of comments here from our website. Jeff says, we already send help. I don't have a problem with a symbolic donation of help from our actual allies, but I don't think we should take on the burden of supporting all refugees worldwide. We already support all of Europe with our strong military, and we're already spending too much. Steve says, we do have a moral obligation, one that we have been ignoring. Our meddling in the Middle East is part of this disaster. Let's go to David in Springfield, Massachusetts for another call. David, welcome to the program. Hello.
Thank you. Now, look at about this thing in the Near East. The government of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have uncountable sums of money, and they should have been prevailed upon to support these people. And there was no reason for the government of Turkey to allow them and encourage them to leave the area of Turkey in the extreme north end of Syria to go to Europe. I believe that we have made a big mistake in not demanding that the government of Saudi Arabia support these people to every penny, because 99% of them are Muslim.
All right, David. Thank you. I'm going to turn that to John Shattuck. John, what about calling on the Saudis and the Qataris and some of the others in the region to help not only house them but pay for this?
Well, certainly they ought to be stepping up and providing much more support, especially to the UN refugee agencies that are taking care of the refugees in Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan, as I said earlier. And part of what I'm calling upon the U.S. to do is to turn to its allies and press them for more support and to do whatever they can do. But I think the United States itself still has a role to play, a major role to play. We have, over the years, given refuge to many different types of people, from fleeing from situations of tyranny or oppression or personal security in times of war. I mentioned the Hungarians, the Poles, the Cuban refugees, the Cambodians, the Vietnamese, the Kosovo refugees. The U.S. has regularly stepped up on both parties. Presidents of both Republican and Democratic presidents have been very much involved in this refugee resettlement. And I don't think we should allow the dangerous rhetoric that is now permeating the American presidential campaign to deter us from doing what we have a long-standing record of doing and obligation to do, in large part because the United States was responsible after the Second World War for creating the whole system of, along with other countries as well, of asylum and refugee opportunities for people fleeing from exactly the kind of circumstances that the Syrians are fleeing from now.
Right. So help us understand historically what worked about Europe post-World War II with regard to the refugees until the end of the 20th century?
Well, I think Europe has grown steadily together since the end of the Second World War. Of course, there was a long period of time, 40 years, during which Europe was divided by the communist and totalitarian regimes in Eastern Europe and the democratic regimes of the West. But as we saw when the changes came in 1989, there was a very strong interest on the part of Eastern Europeans to participate in the development of their countries along democratic lines. And I think Europe has grown together during that period. The European Union has slowly emerged as a framework, very imperfect framework to be sure, and one in which needs a great deal of change. It's a very weak framework. framework, but it's a framework that has prevented largely violence and conflict from emerging on the European continent. Here we are 70 years after the end of the Second World War, and that is still the case. So we don't want to see a return to that. If I could just make one final comment. Over the weekend, I was in Poland, and I went to Auschwitz. And, you know, Auschwitz is the example of what happens when the rule of law and the failure of the international community results in something that is unspeakable, as we all know, like the Holocaust.
Let's go to David in Austin, Texas. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a comment because it feels like over and over again, the conversation never turns to the fact that through the actions of the United States for many decades in the Middle East, and especially beginning with the war in Iraq, where we completely destabilized not only the government, but their capacity as an integral military to continue on and protect that country. Between that and the war in Afghanistan, that we're actually the major creator of a good portion of this immigration challenge right now, and to continue to say, oh, we've sent enough money, we've done enough, belies the fact that we're not taking responsibility for the very actions that helped create a majority of this. And I feel like once we turn that conversation around and find a way to create safe areas for these people in these individual countries that we help protect and we help to build up, that it's just going to be more of the same.
David, thank you. Thank you very much. Does that leave us with a moral responsibility, to David's point, John Shattuck?
Well, I think so, and there's a historical precedent for this. Certainly our reception of Cambodian and Vietnamese refugees after the war in Southeast Asia, which we were very deeply involved in and responsible in many ways for the fact that these people became refugees, I think the U.S. stepped up and recognized its responsibility, moral and security responsibility, to take these people. So I think the situation today with respect to Syrian and even Iraqi refugees coming from the Middle East to Europe, and I'm not saying they should all come to the United States by any means. I'm simply saying we need to support Europe as it tries to deal with these issues. We also need to support the countries who are right out there on the front lines, Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon, where most of the refugees are. And I think we're not doing enough in that regard.
Here's Kayla in Augusta, Georgia. Kayla, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Please go ahead.
I just, you know, there's no right or wrong in this situation. I don't think that the United States is really completely obligated when it comes to letting all of the refugees in. I totally agree that we should help. However, I do believe that we should be vetting these refugees properly. You know, the United States is very unstable right now as it is, just allowing a flood of refugees without any background information on them. That could be a huge security risk. So, you know, I think women and children should definitely have the top priority, while men should be more vetted and background checks run to make sure that they have no affiliations with ISIS or previous violence against them.
Kayla, thank you. Got that point. A lot of listeners have the same question. John Shattuck, what about the safety risks, the security issues of those refugees within the U.S.?
I mentioned earlier, and I'll make the point again, that right now we have the most rigorous method of screening refugees coming into the United States, particularly from the Middle East. And so the system is in place, and it is no system is fail-safe, but it is far more rigorous than any system that a European country is using. So anyone who is accepted as a refugee in the United States will have to go through this vetting process in order to get there. And I think that does deal with the security problem that people are concerned about.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the industries at risk of disruption to understanding bouts of market volatility, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're looking at the EU, the European Union, and the extraordinary challenges it faces from within and from a collapsing Middle East. You can join the conversation. Can the EU stick together if it doesn't solve the refugee crisis? And what does that mean for the U.S., for our security, for our international standing? My guest this hour, John Shattuck, former Assistant Secretary of State, President of the Central European University in Budapest. He's been saying the U.S. needs to help the EU end the refugee crisis. I want to bring in a voice now from the front lines, Afrothiti Vati. She helps run her family's hotel in Molivos on the Greek island of Lesvos. She's seen thousands of refugees appear on the beaches of her town. Afrodite, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me.
You've helped thousands of refugees as they've showed up on your beaches there. Tell us what you've seen over the last couple of years.
I've seen thousands of refugees show up exactly right in front of the beach of the tavern of our hotel, starting last year of April 2015. So I've come face to face with at least 5,000 human beings arriving on plastic dinghies, crossing the Aegean Sea from Turkey, which is about 6 nautical miles across from us, and it has been an amazing experience for us because it was something we didn't expect.
And so what happens when they get there? What do you do?
Well, the first thing we learned very quickly, the first thing that we did was to help them out of the boat safely, to make sure that everyone is okay, that no one needs first aid, or we provided first aid when that was necessary. Many people were wet, terrorized by their journey. We would give them something to drink, something to eat. We quickly got organized and had clothes on call, so we were giving them clothes. We gave them some time to sit and relax, and then finally we were transporting them up to a certain point. In the beginning of this whole crisis, nothing was organized here, so we didn't know what to do. The government wasn't organized. There was no facility on the island set up to take them in, and so what we had to do was quickly find our own solutions, unfortunately. And then at one point, these people had to walk around 75 kilometers to the capital of the island, where the boats are and the airport is. And there, a camp was set up quickly in Moria, outside of the capital. And that's where they had to go to get their papers to be registered. And then they were free to continue traveling on to where their destination was. Up until recently, that is. Then this all changed.
Right. And what happened over the last 3 months?
Well, then the EU came to an agreement with Turkey in order to deal with the situation. And this was all frozen. Suddenly, I want to go backwards a little bit. Up until then, there was not much help from the EU or from our own government. A lot of volunteers and NGOs showed up on the island to take charge, to help with this whole system. In our case, in our hotel, we were dealing with the situation entirely all by ourselves. My family and the guests of our hotel came to our side up until September of 2015. In September, we had the arrival of many volunteers from around the world, and many NGOs started showing up sometime towards the end of summer. Mm-hmm. And they started trying to organize the system to help all these people who had immediate needs. And then when this agreement took place, then this was frozen. And all these refugees who were here in Greece were then stuck here as in Idomeni, in Piraeus, the harbor in Athens, and on our island as well. We have right now around 4,000 refugees stuck in the camps, the one main camp here on the island.
And how has all this affected you? How has it affected your business? How has it affected tourism on the island?
Well, this is something that I've tried to voice my opinion very greatly about. When we're dealing with a refugee crisis, we definitely need to take into consideration how we can support the societies through which the refugees are passing through, because we need to be able to support ourselves so that we can also help with the refugee crisis. Right now, we've been greatly affected in regards to tourism. We're more than 80% down right now, year to date, in reservations. The island itself has had many cancellations in regards to chartered flights, which were arriving here last year. Now we have only about 5 chartered flights arriving to the island. And so right now, how this has affected people, many people won't be working this summertime. After 6 months of unemployment, because we're a touristic region, people work usually 6 months a year, and they're waiting for April, May for businesses to open. Mm-hmm. And now that we have such a huge decrease in tourism, many people will not be hired on this year. And so what we're looking at is a serious social crisis on the verge. We're on the verge of a social crisis, an economic crisis, which we've already been in for the past 6-7 years, is only going to increase. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be a huge, we'll be seeing the aftermath, let's say, within the next 1 or 2 months, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, Aphrodite Vassi, thank you so much for your time, and good luck there in Molivos, Greece. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me go back to the phones here for a moment. Eric in Chicago, Illinois, you've been waiting a while. Welcome to the program. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Good program. I generally disagree with Ambassador's premises and argument here. However, the way it's being made is extremely disingenuous. Namely, the issue doesn't address the issues of the U.S. foreign policy in the region, and also a variety of different problems. For example, I just returned from a reporting trip in Poland and Ukraine, just like the ambassador was just recently there. And there's almost 1 million Ukrainians living in Poland right now as refugees of the situation in Ukraine. So European Union is not only under the stress pressure from the situation in the Middle East, but as well as in Ukraine. And this results specifically from U.S. foreign policy and decisions which have been made recently and so recently. So I think it would be a really great idea to appeal not only to the self-interest, as the ambassador says, but also to the general premise of our foreign policy, as well as the rhetoric that emphasizes human rights and also our responsibility for the situation in the region, which actually we as Americans were very much caused this.
Mm. Eric, thank you. You've heard this a couple of times now, John Shattuck. We helped create this problem. Now it's really a moral and ethical responsibility to help clean it up.
Well, it's certainly part of my argument that that's the case. I don't want to overemphasize that, though, because otherwise we yield to a kind of way of simply looking at this as a moral obligation. I think it's also, and it is a moral obligation, there is no question about that. But what I'm trying to say to the broader American public who may be skeptical about this, what I'm proposing, which is that the U.S. be much more active in supporting the European Union in its dealing with the refugee crisis and accept more refugees ourselves. The arguments are very powerful on the security side. It's in our security interest, and it's and very powerful on the economic side.
So let me jump in here, because more than 30 U.S. governors have refused to accept refugees. Some have called for an outright ban on any refugee fleeing a war. Indiana Governor Mike Pence, one of several U.S. governors who refused to accept Syrian refugees into his state, and Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy was among those who took a different approach. Here he is at a press conference explaining his decision.
It is the right thing to do for us to respond to this tragedy that's playing itself out. We have a obligation to the other nations of the world to do our part. It is the right thing, the humane thing to do. Quite frankly, it's the, if you believe in God, it's the morally correct thing to do.
So there's Governor Malloy of Connecticut. Here he is. He received the 2016 John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award for his support of resettling Syrian refugees in the United States. Here he was accepting the award.
When people will rise up to defame a religious group or a gender group or women, then Americans of good principle and strong heart need to say, not in my land, not in any land.
Back in November, Governor Chris Christie wrote a letter to President Obama saying he would not allow any more refugees in the wake of the Paris terror attacks, but some New Jerseyans defied their governor. Here is part of a news report from a CBS affiliate in New York about a church and a volunteer organization who welcomed refugees. You'll hear first from a CBS reporter, then from Reverend Brad Mota of Mora Church in Maplewood, and finally from Sally Pillay, head of a group called First Friends, who met the Syrian family at the airport.
The family landed at Kennedy Airport Tuesday, and already this congregation has amassed donations to help pay rent on an apartment for the Syrian family of five, not to mention an array of other assistance.
The phone ringing off the hook and emails of people saying, what can I do?
The husband said to me, he feels as if he's dreaming, and the wife, she was literally in tears.
Not so fast, says Frank from our website. Importing impoverished people into the country probably isn't the best plan for widespread economic prosperity, especially when tens of millions of Americans are already poor and already need help. Let's go back to the phones. Dwight in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Dwight, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hello, Jane. I had a question. I have family in Denmark and Norway, and I've seen the turn politically. On the one hand, they both have faced terrorist attacks, though ironically one was domestic in Norway's case. But certainly some of the most economically stable, prosperous nations in Europe, if not the world. And yet the pull of nationalism is obviously strong. It's strong in every Scandinavian country, and it's kind of disconcerting to see countries that have prided themselves on their internationalism. This is all a preface to ask. What are the key markers for European countries that are able to resist nationalism, and why would a country that is doing well economically, actually in a juxtaposition to Greece, which has not been doing well, and the fact that Greece has been supportive, but Denmark and Norway in particular have not been?
Dwight, thank you. John Shattuck, speak to Dwight's point. What are markers? Are there markers for countries who resist nationalism?
Well, the biggest marker is leadership, and political leadership in particular. Those who speak out, as some of the governors that you just played here, Governor Malloy, for example, is a very good example of that in the United States. You know, leadership in Germany, I think, has been very strong on this issue, Chancellor Merkel, but also local leadership. I would cite the leadership in Greece of the local leaders that I met with. I met with the municipal mayor of the Lesbos area, which is where all these refugees were coming in. I also met with the governor of the Attica region of Greece. And these people were making the kinds of comments that need to be made, which is, we have a moral obligation, but also we can benefit from refugees who come into our country, particularly those that are that bring special talents. Another marker, I would say, is history. And here, I think Germany and particularly Chancellor Merkel herself have been deeply touched by the terrible history of Germany in the Second World War. And I think that that is affecting the way in which they're going about this. In the case of the Greeks, I think their own experience as refugees and as people who are really constantly pushed around for a long period of time, and even today, in that sense, they feel pushed around by the EU. I think that that provides a kind of a humane approach, which is not foolproof. Nationalism is very much alive and well in both Germany and Greece, but leadership makes a difference.
You mentioned Angela Merkel. She's paid a real political price, has she not, for her relatively enlightened refugee policy, as you call it? I mean, 6 months ago, she was hailed as the savior of Europe, and now her approval ratings really are at the lowest of her tenure chancellorship. And she has some real pushback from the far right wing of her party, who's now proposing banning burqas, minarets, a Muslim call to prayer. I mean, there are real pushbacks to that kind of leadership in Germany, for one.
Well, it's true. But I would say in a certain way, she has been a profile in courage. Governor Malloy received the award yesterday. But I think Angela Merkel constantly speaking, in a sense, against her own political self-interest has been another example of the kind of leadership one needs. And, you know, leadership shouldn't simply be reflecting the worst instincts of people who are your voters. It should rather be trying to lead them in directions that relate to the larger self-interest that you have as a country or even moral interest that you that we have as humanity.
Let me ask you about Libya and Italy in the last couple of minutes here. They could soon become the new major routes for refugees hoping to reach Western Europe. So the boundaries are changing, right? The lines are changing. The routes are changing. How does that change the calculus as we move forward?
Well, the tragedy of people who take to boats, flimsy boats, and try to make it all across the Mediterranean has now been played out again and again. We've seen serious drownings and problems of all kinds emerging, but the push is very strong. I think some of the refugees coming from the Libyan part are perhaps less, shall we say, traditional refugees seeking asylum as they are people who are seeking to start another way of life, which is fully understandable, but they end up getting perhaps treated somewhat separately as a result under the refugee laws. And I think the numbers are not going to reach the same enormous numbers that they were because of Lesbos being so close to, after all, 6 miles away from the Turkish border. So if you ask for a simple prediction, I think we're going to continue to see a strong push by refugees to come into Europe, but it's a very risky route. There's a lot of rescue missions that are now out in the Mediterranean, and I would salute the Italians for doing what they can to try to rescue people in that terrible situation.
John Shattuck, former Assistant Secretary of State and President of the Central European University in Budapest. John, so important to hear what you've been seeing and your thoughts today from Europe. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, we look at how one woman prepares for the full onset of Alzheimer's disease. Until then, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.